Hello, welcome to Akbar's Chamber. I'm your host, Niall Green. And in this episode, we're going to be talking about the Muslims of China and the transformation of their religious traditions in the 20th century through their connections with Muslims in the Middle East. China has a Muslim population of around 20 million. And the Muslims of China are divided into not only a range of different ethnic groups, a series of different minzu, ethnic minorities, as they're called in the classifications of the People's Republic, but the Muslims of China also practice a range of different Islams, and indeed have a range of different languages, both religious and everyday. In this episode, we're going to be speaking about the Sinophone, the Chinese-speaking Muslims. That's to say, we're not going to be focusing upon the Turkic or the Uyghur Muslims of China, who have a somewhat different history. The Chinese-speaking Muslims, including the Hui, but also some other groups, as we'll discuss, have a history in China, or at least a history of living under Chinese rule, the rule of Chinese empires, and then in the 20th century, a secular and then a communist republic. And indeed, across the centuries of living in China, the Chinese-speaking Muslims that not only speak Chinese, but they write in Chinese and have adapted their religious traditions to Chinese life, to the Chinese language, and indeed to various other aspects of Chinese thought. But by the late 19th century, as a result of new interactions through steamships, not least, with Muslims in other regions, particularly the Middle East, the late Ottoman Empire, and then the new state of Saudi Arabia, a whole series of religious reforms began in China. That's what we're going to be focusing on over the next hour. How Chinese Islam changed, and how the Chinese-speaking Muslims themselves interacted with Muslims from elsewhere and indeed drew on the great religious debates in the Middle East in the modern era. We'll begin by asking and exploring who are the Sinophone or the Chinese-speaking Muslims, and indeed, are they the same as the people that are sometimes called the Hui? And then tracing the changes of their religiosity across the 20th century, we'll be exploring a range of new organizations, particularly the Ikhwan and the Chinese Salafis that emerged over the course of the 20th century. Leading us in this conversation is Dr. Mohammed Sudairi, who is lecturer in politics and international relations at the Australian National University in Canberra. He's the author of many articles drawing on his expertise in both Arabic and in Chinese, including, most relevant to what we're discussing today, his article, Traditions of Mataridism and Anti-Wahhabism in China, which is published in the Journal of Islamic Studies in 2021. Hello, Mohammed. Welcome to Akbar's Chamber.
Oh, thank you for having me, Niall. It's wonderful and a great opportunity.
Well, it's a great opportunity for me and all of our listeners to learn from you today as we talk about the history, the modern, the 20th, early 21st century history of a really fascinating Muslim community, the Hui of China, who I'll set out by calling, at least for simplification, the Chinese-speaking Muslims of China, perhaps to distinguish more easily from the more familiar facade, the more familiar Turkic Uyghurs of northwest China. But you should be telling us who they are rather than me. So to begin, Muhammad, can you firstly tell us who are the Hui Muslims of China? And secondly, can you outline their religious practices, their religious landscape, their religious traditions before they came into contact with Middle Eastern Muslim reformists in the later 19th and 20th century?
I mean, the question is deceptively simple, but it's extremely complex. And in fact, when you ask who are the Hui, it depends on really the epoch and, of course, the positionality of the person who's looking at these groupings of Muslims and identifying them with whatever terminology they so wish. So, for instance, if we go back to the Song period, roughly the 11th, 12th centuries, the term Hui, or Huihe or Huihu, used to actually refer to Buddhist Turkic Muslims in what is today identified as Xinjiang. In kind of the Mongol period, which is from the 13th century onwards, the term Hui becomes much more concretely identified with Muslims as such. And the religion of Islam is called Huijiao, the teachings of Hui. And in fact, this is the term that is still used to describe Islam in Taiwan, while in China in the early 1950s, they made the official transition from calling it Huijiao into Isilanjiao, the religion or the teachings of Islam. And I think what took place in the early 20th century is a debate regarding the term Hui. So you've had a grouping of Muslim elites in kind of the Republican era that began after the revolution of 1911 and kind of the abdication of the Qing dynasty in 1912, about kind of what is the status and position of Muslims as such within this new nation state. So there was kind of groupings that advocated for the conceptualization of Hui as being that of Turkic Muslims. So what we would call the Uyghurs are the Hui, while others preferred kind of the old nomenclature of saying that, well, the Hui are all Muslims in China, including Turkic and Chinese-speaking Muslims. But there was, of course, another group that advocated for a conceptualization of the Hui as being separate from Turkic Muslims. And kind of that position was taken on by the Communist Party of China. So even in their early revolutionary period in the 1940s, I think best exemplified by the Huihui Minzuwenti, the Huihui ethnicity question document, which was published in 1941, they were trying to kind of figure out the place of these Muslims who, based on kind of the Stalinist criteria of what constituted a nation, couldn't easily fit into it. Essentially the idea was that a nation had to have a fixed geography, a particular language, a particular economic system that defined it, a culture and psychology, et cetera. And it was easy to kind of slot in different groups based on kind of Soviet precedent into these kind of ethnic terms, like Uyghurs, Kazakhs, and so forth. But with other Muslim communities that spoke local vernaculars that are everywhere in China, it was kind of difficult to identify them as part of one ethnic group. But the position that they had pushed was to identify them as part of this larger Huizu or Hui ethnicity that was influenced by Islam, but was not determined by its Muslim faith, which was kind of paradoxical and problematic. But so when we enter into the 1950s and when the state begins to construct its ethnic minority system, defined by having 56 ethnic groups, of course, the Han being one of these groupings and constituting something like 91 to 92% of the total population, the Hui minority is created. And so the Hui refers to a discrete grouping of people who are different from the nine other ethnic minorities whose members are considered to be majority Muslim, right? Like the Ba'an or the Salar or whomever. And of course, this causes problems when we come and study Chinese Islam. Because, for instance, it, within the Chinese state, it's not permitted for anyone to really conduct surveys on religious beliefs, right? So we don't actually have a good sense of how many religious believers there are with regards to Islam or Christianity or whomever. But there are, of course, surveys conducted about the number of ethnic minorities. So, for instance, the Hui are roughly 10.5, right? And actually, the total population of Muslims is sometimes given as 23 million based on the accumulated number of those 10 ethnic minorities that are considered to be majority Muslim. But there are immediate problems that emerge with that because obviously not all members of these ethnic groupings are Muslims, right? You can have people who are atheists, people who don't have any particular religious beliefs or had converted to other religions, right? But also, it doesn't really, or rather, it invisibilizes the fact that there are other communities of people who are ethnically not slotted as being part of these 10 Muslim majority ethnic minorities that are Muslims. There are Han converts to Islam, for instance. There are Tibetans who are Muslims. So it's really difficult to get a sense of how many Muslims there are in China today. And again, this is why terms like, well, Hui, as denoting Muslims can be a bit problematic. There's significant overlap, but that is not always the case.
Interesting, because what you've outlined for us there really is that the consequences for us when we're trying to talk about Muslims in China, in particular Muslims, of the transitions of modern Chinese history that were there in the background for what you've been explaining for us, Mohammed, which is the shift from an imperial state, the last Chinese empire, the Qing, then from 1912, a nationalist nation state, and then from 1949 to a communist state. And this shift from religious classifications, religious communities, to these more modern types of nation state that want to think about people in ethnic terms. And this crucial word that you use, the word Minzu, for a minority. And then we have these ethnic minorities around 10 they're considered to be Muslim. So yes, indeed. And the Hui then are one of these groups then, or at least as they're often called in the scholarship, one of these state classified minorities that speak Chinese, that eventually had developed over the centuries a long tradition of, or at least a se several centuries tradition, the Han Kitab, which you might tell us about, the Chinese language texts about Islam, that they have drawn on the Persian and indeed in previous centuries, of course, the Arabic texts of Islam, but also their own distinctive Chinese and Chinese language religious tradition. So with that in mind, perhaps we can return to that second part of my question, Mohammed, about can you outline for us then the religious practices then of the Chinese speaking Muslims before they start to come into contact then with the Middle Eastern, particularly Arabic speaking Muslims of the Middle East in the modern period?
I should perhaps before jumping into that question and try tackling it, is to just maybe clarify also another point, which is when we talk about Hui Muslims, I think the emphasis on kind of this ethnicity paradigm also doesn't allow us to realize that in fact the Hui are in constant interaction with other groups that today are also identified as distinct ethnic minorities, right? The Salar, the Dongxiang, et cetera. And when we look backward in time, we'll come to realize that these communities were so interlinked with one another that when we talk about their religious history, right, like the Salar, for example, are a big component in many of the Naqshbandi religious movements, or a lot of the prominent figures of the Ikhwan reformist movement that we'll talk about later are from the Dongxiang background. Ma Wanfu is presumably such that to speak in the language of the state and its emphasis on ethnicity can be very distortive, I think, in terms of kind of figuring out. So when we say Hui Muslims, it's a bit problematic, and I would actually opt and prefer for Sinophone or Chinese-speaking Muslims, right? You know, kind of people who speak different vernaculars of Chinese, who occupy a similar Sinophone universe. but of also might have their own ancillary or other languages that they speak, right? And I should also note that, you know, at least when we in the Northwestern context that I'm most familiar with, which is kind of the Hexi corridor that extends from kind of the easternmost boundaries of Xinjiang or Turkestan or Altishahar and into kind of Qinghai, Gansu, and Ningxia, that whole region, even when we say Sinophone, it's Sinophone in a very loose and borderland type of way. Because, you know, for instance, there's a tradition of the Xiao Arjing, which is kind of writing Chinese vernaculars that have a significant amount of Arabic, but even more so Persian terms, using Arabic script. And that tradition had existed for centuries and continued well into the 20th century. I mean, that's Sinophone, albeit, you know, kind of through Arabic legibility and script. So that's kind of just something I wanted to point out. Now, turning kind of to the religious landscape, I would say that there are, at least following the end of the Mongol Imperium and the fall of the Yuan Dynasty, roughly in the mid 14th century, you could say that in China, there are kind of two main clusters of religious traditions. One cluster, which really began to emerge roughly in the Ming and into the Qing periods, is based in Eastern China, in Shandong, in the Jiangnan region, which is where Nanjing is centered in. And kind of that tradition was part of an attempt to preserve Islam after kind of the cultural closures that took place following the fall of the Mongol Yuan dynasty. And it's kind of embodied best by, for instance, the Han Kitab traditions, which is kind of an attempt by different Muslim literati who are conversant in the Confucian classics and kind of the Confucian worldview to present Islam through a Confucian lens, people like Wang Dayu or Liu Zhi, for example, or Ma Zhu. But also kind of another facet of that tradition, which is distinct in some ways, is the scriptural hall education system, right? Which was kind of pioneered by Hu Dongzhou in the 16th century. And it was kind of an attempt to, first of all, identify theological and legal literatures, and also kind of developing pedagogical tools for relating Islam to future generations of Muslims, right, who were increasingly, in fact, losing their linguistic capacity to read Arabic and Persian texts. And in this is kind of the first cluster. The second cluster, which is in the Northwest, and it's very closely intermeshed with Central Asia and Turkestan, is kind of the emergence of what one could call our different forms of the Sufi tradition. Kind of the entry of the Naqshbandi orders in the 16th and 17th centuries into Northwest China. The Qadiriyya, for example, also established a very early presence in China. And that is kind of the second, I would say, major cluster in the pre-modern era. Now, I should say kind of a few more things. One is that when we think of it in kind of broader categories, while I kind of firmly believe that Chinese Islam had for a very long time a type of confessional ambiguity that you see marking much of the Islamic practice across Eurasia, I don't think people actively thought of themselves as Sunni or Shiite. And, you know, there was a lot of kind of aesthetical choices and ritual practices that some scholars believe reflect Shi'i influences. We could say that looking at the existing texts and literatures that were being used by Muslims in the pre-modern era, that for the most part, they adhered to Hanafi conceptualizations of the law. So they're Hanafi and Madhab, very much like their co-religionists in Central Asia and the subcontinent. And there is, in fact, quite intimate circulations of texts between India and China. And I think Ryan Thum is actually exploring that aspect. I mean, for example, As-Sarahindi's work, Al-Rasa'il al-Rabbaniyya, we find indications that it had entered China in the 16th and 17th centuries. So quite relatively quick, in fact, transmissions. But also in terms of doctrine, I would say that Chinese Muslims, for the most part, looking at the texts that we can access from different libraries and different archival sources across the country, is that they are Maturidis, right? For the most part, right? We can see Al-Aqa'id al-Nasafiyya, Sharh al-Aqa'id al-Nasafiyya by Taftazani. So theologically and legally, the predominant practice is that of Hanafi Maturidism, right? I should say that that does not discount the existence of Shi'i communities in China, some of which may have gone extinct. I mean, there's a lot of interesting discussion about sources from the medieval era and even during Ibn Battuta's time when he visited China under Mongol rule. There was certainly one rebellion that took place around the city of Quanzhou in the early 13th century, or mid 13th century, called the Safi Rebellion, which was presumed to have involved the Shi'i garrison there. But for the most part, in present day China, there are really three very small Shi'i presences that I can think of. One is in the extreme west of Xinjiang, which is kind of part of the Badakhshan geographic zone and Gilgit-Baltistan. So there is an Ismaili presence there, but it's around maybe 50, 60,000 people at most. And then of course, there's a few Twelver Shiite communities that are of course Chinese citizens in southern Xinjiang. You have kind of small communities of Shiite foreign Muslims in places like Yiwu in the east or in Guangzhou, right? I kind of looked into that in my research in terms of shared spaces between Chinese Muslims and foreign Muslims, you know. And also the third cluster being the longstanding communities of different Shi'i traditions in Hong Kong that came with British rule. So the Bukhras, for example, who had been very well established from the mid 19th century, and have kind of significant shipping interests and commercial interests in the city. Now, just to kind of maybe wrap up on the question of the religious landscape, and again, this is kind of drawing on more contemporary terminology, kind of based on the work of Ma Tong, who is considered to be kind of one of the key fathers of Islamic studies in China. Is, you know, he tends to categorize Chinese Muslim groupings into four or five categories. And I think for our interest, at least when we talk about kind of the pre-modern era, is the Qadim and the Sufi Menhuan, right? And the Qadim here, you know, I personally think that the term probably emerged sometime in the 19th century, but there's a debate. Different scholars have different views about it. I mean, I see that as kind of a term that was introduced in the context of reformist dynamics that were criticizing older practices, similar to what was happening in Central Asia between the Jadid and the Qadim Lar, for example. But other scholars have a different view. But essentially, Qadim is a term that reflects or refers to Muslim communities that follow older forms of Islam, kind of Hanafi inherited forms of practice, ritual practices. They're relatively acculturated and had taken on different Chinese, they've adopted Chinese aesthetic choices and practiced Chinese festivals to some extent, or even rituals. And one good example is funerals. So for instance, they don white cloth for funerals, which is considered to be kind of a distinctly non-Muslim practice. They hold commemorations for the dead at a certain number of days after their passing, 3 days, 7 days, a month later, et cetera. And all of these are kind of condemned by reformists. And the Qadim are kind of imagined as being very decentralized and not organized around any larger supra-organization or brotherhood. So they're kind of mosque-centered communities. And these are, I would say, all across China. And in fact, the first cluster that I had mentioned, the people who follow kind of, or are products of the scriptural hall education system, or the people who follow the Han Kitab traditions would fall under that rubric, right? And then of course, the second group being the Sufi tariqas, the menhuan. And again, there's a debate about whether menhuan actually refers to tariqas as such. But I think, you know, there is a relative overlap between the two concepts. And the Sufi tariqas are largely centered in Northwest China. And of course, they have a long history of violent confrontations with the state. And in fact, that was one of the reasons why we find some of these tariqas developing a presence in other Chinese borderland regions, such as in the Southwest in Yunnan or in the Northeast, the Dongbei region, primarily because the Qing authorities exiled a lot of their followers or leaders in the aftermath of significant rebellions. And I think maybe just as a concluding point to that is, you know, there is one kind of paradigm that people like Joseph Fletcher, the late Joseph Fletcher from Harvard of Turkic Studies, and even the late Drew Gladney, who was a big, of course, father figure for the field of Chinese Islamic studies, at least in the Anglophone traditions, is that, you know, kind of one of the ways of understanding the history of Islam in China is through that of waves, right? So this notion that, you know, these communities were disconnected from the Islamic hinterlands is something that, you know, we should be wary against. Because again, the entrance of the Naqshbandi, for example, brotherhoods or the other Sufi traditions is very much tied to the 16th and 17th century wider Sufi revivals that were taking place, right? So what happens in the late 19th, early 20th century with these kind of influences coming from other Islamic hinterlands, the Ottoman Empire, Egypt, are not new.
That's really helpful, Mohammed. You've laid out this really complex landscape, which when we actually think of the sheer scale, the geography of the, well, you've taken us back to the Mongol Empire, at least, haven't you? And then in the Yuan Dynasty in China, and indeed to the final Qing Empire up until 1911, 1912. It's not surprising that we're getting this sort of internal variety of different ethnic, different linguistic, and different sectarian and sort of different religious traditions within among the different Muslims of China. And then these internal drives, then I guess these sort of internal variations with the kind of, well, to use that metaphor, the waves of occasional sort of waves of new ideas, new institutions, the Naqshbandi order founded in Central Asia, goes to South Asia, and then in some of the texts that you've mentioned by, by Ahmad Syed Hindi then, from written in the, I guess, the early 1600s, then they're coming into China in turn. So it's not that China's been cut off from South Asia or Central Asia, and it's had its internal dynamics as well. But what we're going to turn to now then is these connections with perhaps the West Asia, the Middle East, rather than South and Central Asia, and a series of new reform movements that then come out of these connections, particularly with Egypt, and ultimately, as we'll see as well, with Saudi Arabia itself, a new state, of course, founded in 1925. So let's turn then to these 20th century reform movements, religious reform movements among the Chinese Muslims. And let me ask you, why and how did a small but I suppose influential number of Sinophone Muslim students and scholars start to learn from Arab Muslim, or at least Arabic speaking and Arabic writing Muslim reformists in the Middle East?
It's a great question. I would say that there are probably three factors that kind of influenced or shaped the process of engagement between Sinophone Muslims and the Middle Eastern hinterlands. I would say the first one is, of course, the 19th century context, which, you know, your edited volume, Muslims in the Age of Steam and Print, really well encapsulates, is that, you know, the global order forged by European imperialism really brought disparate regions of the world closely together through technologies and new infrastructures, particularly steamships. So while in past centuries, you would have, you know, particular notable figures going to the Hejaz or Yemen and they come back with such significant cultural social capital that they become effectively spiritual founders or leaders of different movements of reform. I mean, both of the Naqshbandiya orders in China, their leaders, Ma Laichi or Ma Mingxin, supposedly went to the West in the 17th century, or even Ma Fuchu, who was a reformist in Yunnan, who went in the mid 19th century. These kind of singular visits were replaced by a growing number of people who were able to go westward as a result of these new Indian oceanic connectivities, right? So that's one important kind of factor. The second one is, I think, kind of the an indirect one that kind of elicited the interest of the Muslim hinterlands in courting and supporting Sinophone Muslims to come to their lands to study is the specter of pan-Islamism. So in the 1860s and in 70s, you know, there was kind of massive rebellions, or at least, I mean, it's difficult really to describe them in all cases as rebellions, but essentially violent confrontations between Muslim communities and the imperial authorities in places like Yunnan, where a short-lived sultanate had existed, across the northwest of China, which led to massive demographic shifts and changes from Shaanxi all the way to the west, and also in what the area we call today is Xinjiang. Now, because of this kind of widespread Muslim violence or violence with the state, it alerted European observers to the presence of Muslims as such. So we begin to see the emergence of this whole literature of writings by Russian sinologists and European or French diplomats writing about Muslims. And, you know, kind of this was then incorporated or assimilated into this budding kind of European vision of the fear or the specter of Muslim solidarity globally, right? And what's interesting, I mean, I'm now working on a paper looking at kind of the way in which this fear of a Muslim presence in China, which was actually interpreted in very exaggerated ways. I mean, there was a belief that there was an imminent Muslim takeover of China, the transformation of China into a Muslim kingdom that would shift the geopolitical and demographic balance of power globally between Christendom and Islamdom, is that it kind of seeps into the Ottoman and Arab traditions, right? So Chinese Muslims, for the first time by the turn of the century, are incorporated into these budding imaginaries about the Muslim Ummah, right? I mean, if you look at, for example, Abdurrahman al-Kawakibi's fictional account of a pan-Islamic conference in Mecca, Umm al-Qura, right? Which a lot of people mistook as an actual event. One of the figures or participants is al-Imam al-Sini, you know, the Chinese Imam, who is kind of an embodiment or representation of that element from the Muslim Ummah. So anyway, these ideas begin to seep in, and there becomes this growing interest to support the Muslim communities in China. You know, the Ottomans become very active, right? They get solicitations from Wang Quan, who is the reformist from Beijing, and the Ottomans support him to establish what effectively becomes the Dar al-Ulum al-Hamidiyya in Beijing. And even kind of the post-Ottoman states, they inherit that mantle of supporting Chinese Muslims. I mean, of course, it's not just particular to Chinese Muslims. They see this as a global mandate of support. So the Egyptians, the Egyptian sultans in the 1920s and 1930s also take a very active interest in the affairs of Chinese Muslims. I mean, they offer scholarships. There's the famous Azharite missions that were comprised of Muslims who came from some of the new modern reformist schools in Beijing, but also in Jinan, in Shanghai, and other places. They offer donations of books, right? The King Farouk Library now is still there in Beijing. It's part of the collection of the Islamic Association of China in the Dongsa Mosque. And actually, I even found like some of the memoirs of some of the muftis of Al-Azhar in the 1930s, where they're actually kind of debating and discussing the importance of much more active engagement with Chinese Muslims. Because again, this is tied to the European fears about the Muslim presence in China, because I mean, these fears kind of evolve in a direction where increasingly, particularly European missionaries see Chinese Muslims as a potential vulnerable target for conversion and kind of an entryway into converting the rest of China into Christianity. So groups like the Christian Inland Mission were very active in producing a lot of literature in Arabic directed at Chinese Muslims. So a lot of institutions back in the Muslim hinterlands become very worried about these Christian overtures and interests in Chinese Muslims. So they begin to conceptualize their role as part of an attempt to save their brethren from conversion. So for instance, Al-Azhar sends two teachers to Beijing in the late 1920s and 1930s. And all of that is in the memoirs, right? It's kind of overly stated and openly so. The last factor, which I think is very important, and I think is really the core driver of kind of this reformist interest in engaging the Muslim hinterlands, is I think a kind of collective reflection on the part of Muslim elites in China in the aftermath of the Muslim rebellions, right? Because there was such considerable violence meted out and uprootment of Muslim communities all across the country. And of course, there was another cycle of rebellion with its own violence in the mid 1890s, that it kind of prompted an interest in the question of what went wrong, and another kind of associated question of what is to be done. So for instance, you know, I think one tendency that emerged among Chinese Muslims, and this is the group that I'm particularly interested in my research, is the Ikhwan, who kind of saw that one of the big drivers of violence was the conflict and competition both within and between the different Sufi tariqas, right? So that became part of their call for orthopraxic reform, to move away from the veneration of shrines, to stop emphasizing too much the sacredness of the lineage of the shuyukh of the tariqas and so forth. So I think it's very important to take into consideration the shadow of this violence from the 19th century and how much it drove kind of a reflective and reformist spirit among Chinese Muslims, especially going into the 1910s and the 1920s, right? And of course, there's a larger zeitgeist that was affecting China as a whole, which is, you know, rethinking questions about the intellectual tradition, Chinese culture, how to modernize. And I think all of these seeped into Muslim debates as well, obviously, right?
So we get in this sense then of these internal factors, the collapse of the Qing Empire, the Muslim rebellions, as they're sometimes called, but of course, as you explained, the great violence in turn against different Muslim communities by attempts to bring them back under the fold of the Qing Empire, and then the Republic of China before the Communist state, which we'll move to from 1949. And this is bringing then, as you've mentioned, then these external interests by Christian missionaries from the US and Europe, as well as the last major Muslim empire, the Ottoman Empire, and then also, as we'll perhaps turn to, as well as Egypt and the great seminary, the great Muslim University of Al-Azhar that you've mentioned, then also of Saudi Arabia, then founded in 1925, and of course a promoter of its own vision of Salafi Wahhabi reformist Islam, if that's perhaps an appropriate term. So these new contacts then with the Middle East through the different infrastructures that you've mentioned, steam travel not least, and particularly with the new state of Saudi Arabia, then helped generate several different reform movements among the Chinese speaking Muslims and between them and co-religionists in the Middle East. So, can you tell us, Mohammed, about the development of two of the particular and perhaps most important of these reformments, the Ikhwan, I guess the brothers, to put it in English, and the Chinese Salafis, as distinct from, but of course related to, the Middle Eastern Salafis, and perhaps also give us a little sense of the differences and disagreements between the Ikhwan and the Chinese Salafis.
So going back to kind of that classification system of the Islamic landscape that Ma Tong had kind of proposed, right? If we talked about the Qadim as one group, the Sufi Menhwan or the Tariqas as another kind of cluster or group, we also have kind of three others. The Shidaotang, which we don't need to go into that much, but they're essentially also part of this local reformist movements that emerged in the northwest of China. But what's interesting is that they kind of turned to the Han Kitab traditions of old, which were not particularly popular in the northwest, and kind of also adopted a communalistic lifestyle in terms of their way of organizing the community. Mary Paul Hill is really the authority on the Shidaotang, and I encourage, the listeners who might be interested in learning about them to engage with her work. But then there are two other groupings, which are sometimes kind of joined into one another, the Ikhwan and the Salafis. Now, the Ikhwan, I would say that the general Chinese as well as Western scholarship, which I disagree with, see them as being born from Wahhabi influences. And the idea being is that the founder of the Ikhwan had gone to the Hijaz in the early 1890s, roughly, and had stayed there for extended study. Of course, at that time, there was no Saudi state yet into being. I mean, this was in the interregnum between the second and third Saudi states. But the idea being is that he had studied there for under a few Wahhabi authorities whom we don't really know much about. I mean, one is a Khalil Basha, who could be really anyone. And it's kind of an interesting mystery to dig into who exactly these figures are. But then that he came back to China bringing in a set of texts that are oftentimes just simply identified as Wahhabi. And of course, some of them we could identify as being kind of part of the classical Salafi corpus, like Ibn al-Qayyim al-Jyush al-Islamiyya, right? Ibn Taymiyyah's disciple, or Kitab al-Tawheed for Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab. But in my opinion, kind of scrutinizing the different secondary sources that list the texts that the founder of the Ikhwan had brought in. And again, this is a very problematic approach because, in fact, one of the big mysteries with the Ikhwan is that we don't have any surviving writings by the founder himself. Presumably, he wrote a text called the Bukhari Zadeh, which was later destroyed by the authorities in the Northwest before he got patronage by Muslim warlords in Qinghai. But even then, when he went into that patronage, which extended for more than a decade and a half, he never actually recompiled or wrote any texts of his own, which again is a really big mystery. So we don't really know the particulars, and we have very limited sources about the early beginnings of this movement and its orientation. However, looking at the secondary sources that list the various texts that they brought, including, by the way, secondary sources that are, or we could call them primary sources by their detractors, we can see that they were quite eclectic, right? And the type of text that people like Mawanfu, but even his successors later on had brought. I mean, for example, they brought the Tariqa al-Muhammadiyya, which is a key text of the Birqavi movement in the Ottoman Empire in the 16th and 17th centuries. They were clearly bringing in books of kalam. And in fact, we have some evidence to suggest that they were interested in ilm al-kalam in the early beginnings of the Ikhwani movement. So, I mean, kind of digging into that various that kind of literature, however sparse it is, it seems to me that the Ikhwan are more appropriately part of the Islamic milieu that had existed in China for many centuries. That is to say, in orientation, they're Maturidi, not a Salafi, and also Hanafi in terms of their madhabi orientation. I mean, they're using al-Fiqh al-Akbar, attributed to the Imam Abu Hanifa. And so forth. There's a bit of a problem in considering them kind of Wahhabi inspired. I mean, they were certainly orthopraxic and they emphasized kind of an anti, or they took an anti-Sufi stance, right? And one could interpret that in terms of the political environment itself in the Northwest, which was dominated by a lot of Sufi tariqas. But again, also this critique in and of its own right is not unique to non-Salafi Sunni contexts elsewhere. I mean, the Birqavi movement of the 16th century was very much against shrine veneration, right? So this is kind of the basic orientation of the Ikhwan, and I think it's kind of confirmed by post-1980s internal dissensions within the Ikhwani movement itself, which I'm interested in my own research, because generally speaking, after the reform and opening up had started in China, the Ikhwan had kind of slowly broken off into two groupings. One grouping that's oftentimes described as the hardliners, kind of in their own literature and publications, are very active in emphasizing the Hanafi Maturidi identity of the movement, right? And kind of saying that in fact the softliners, the other group, who are much more institutionally embedded within kind of state-promoted organizations and mosques, et cetera, have allowed themselves to be hijacked by Wahhabism, right? So even recently, a few years ago, when the grandson of the founder of the Ikhwan, Ma Changqing, who heads the kind of the main mosque of the Ikhwani movement in the northwest in Xining, had passed away. He was replaced by Ma Yueqiang, another imam, who for a long time had been accused by the hardliners as being kind of Salafi leaning, right? And you know, effectively, the hardliners depicted this whole appointment as a Trojan horse aimed at undermining the Ikhwani movement. And kind of Wahhabizing it with state support. So I think these kind of even later conflicts are really, really highlight, I think, the overall orientation of the Ikhwan. Now, I accept, of course, the criticism from other scholars that I completely respect, for instance, Leila Chibbi, who is a major authority on the Ikhwan, that you know, there might have been different traditions within the early Ikhwan, because you know, I mostly focus on the folks in Qinghai. But there's also other clusters of the Ikhwan and Ningxia and so forth. And so it could be possible that there were many points of diffusion and very different interpretations. But I think overall, the Ikhwan are better conceptualized as being part of the pre-existing Islamic milieu. Now, the Salafis, they kind of come in the 1930s and 1940s, at least from the existing record. And again, the information about them is quite sparse. The basic idea is that Ma Dabao and Ma Zhangqing, kind of the main founders or kind of initiators of the Salafiyya tradition in China, had gone to the Hijaz on pilgrimage and had studied there for an extended period of time in Mecca. It's particularly interesting because Ma Dabao presumably studied under Sultan Ma'sum al-Khujandi. And there's actually a wonderful PhD dissertation by Muhammad Bushra, who had just graduated from Georgetown University, on him. And he's kind of, you know, part of that global, very mobile Muslim from Central Asia, who kind of, you know, shifted constantly his confessional and intellectual allegiances, kind of Jadidi mold, Salafi mold, et cetera, and but was also engaged with Chinese Northwest. I mean, when he escaped from the Bolsheviks in the late 1910s, he went and taught in Xinjiang proper, and he's kind of very familiar with the Chinese Islamic landscape. And even when he went to the Hijaz later on, he maintained very close links with Muslims in East Asia. He's very notable, for example, for a text called Risala ila Muslimi Yaban, where he kind of offers an opinion on madhhabi differences among Japanese Muslims, right, in terms of how to properly conduct themselves and which madhhab should they prioritize in their congregational prayers. But he also maintained very close ties with the Chinese Salafis. So in any case, Ma Dabao, he studied under him, and presumably when he returned, that's when he initiated the Salafiyya movement. And you know, usually the Western and Chinese scholarships depict the core difference between the Ikhwan and the Salafiyya as essentially being one of legal differences, right? Between, say, the Hanafism of the Ikhwan and the Hanbalism of the Salafiyya. And you know, people tend to point at the derogatory term used to describe the Salafis in China, which is the Santai, the sect of the three elevations, you know, kind of indicating when people raise their hands in the start of the prayer before bowing and before prostrating, right? But I think, again, that's kind of a bit of a misinterpretation because, yes, the Madhabi differences are there, although they don't really come to the forefront until the late 1940s and, of course, after the communist takeover. Because, you know, the context for this is that from the 1920s all the way to 1949, the Ikhwan are given considerable support by the local authorities. The Muslim warlords, who maybe just to kind of inform the readers, got power in the aftermath of the Muslim rebellions, especially the ones from the 1890s, because what happened is that the Qing authorities kind of, and even before that, but the Qing authorities kind of used local Muslim elites to control the Muslim populations. And they used these elites in the context of their military suppression. So these elites became kind of military commanders. They had their own armies. So when the Republican era came about, they established kind of effective political authority over many of these places. And one particular cluster of Muslim warlords, in particularly in Qinghai and Ningxia, they supported the Ikhwan and offered them considerable support, right? And my argument actually is that this was part of a project to unify and end sectarian differences, or what were perceived to be sectarian differences among Muslim communities. So effectively, they kind of waged suppressive campaigns against the Sufi tariqas. They intervened into public rituals that were deemed to be incorrect, right, and unorthodox, etc. But so people who were Salafi leaning, like Madhabao, could not really express themselves openly. And in fact, I think he was still part of the Ikhwan, or identified himself as part of the Ikhwan. But I think his main issue of contention, and this is where I differ from the Western and Chinese scholarship, was really over doctrine. Because if you look at all the existing material that we have, it's really about how, for example, to properly interpret the Quran. So for instance, in very typical Maturidi tradition, the Ikhwani emphasis was on ta'wil, that, you know, the interpretation of certain verses in the Quran are open to allegorical interpretation, right? Like, for example, when we say the face of God, wajhullah, or yadullah, that the hand of God, or God sitting on the throne, right? That was a big issue. They offer many different types of interpretations. You know, that's a display of God's power, that's a display of God's this. But in terms of the Salafis, what we find is that they begin to enter into debates about how to actually properly interpret the Quran, and whether kind of a bila kayf scripturalist interpretation should be emphasized against this allegorical interpretation. You know, so the main split, and again, I think this is, you know, when we think of kind of how the Ikhwan have been interpreted as a Wahhabi movement, or what are the origins of the Salafi Ikhwani split, it's because people have ignored theology, right? And kind of the importance of doctrinal issues. And again, I've had this debate with colleagues who are engaged in the field of Chinese Islamic studies, and there are different opinions. People say, well, you're overemphasizing theology, which I fully understand and accept. But I think by virtue of ignoring it, we're really kind of ignoring some of the primary fault lines for understanding the evolution of these traditions, at least at the level of the ulama, at the level of people who are embedding themselves as religious entrepreneurs, right? Like the Salafiyya. So yeah, I'm sorry I took you in many different directions, but this is kind of the how I see the Ikhwan and the Salafiyya and their genesis stories in the early 20th century.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, as you pointed out to us, really, that so much of the scholarly, the outside interest in the Chinese Muslims, and indeed of the different Chinese Muslim sects, is actually coming out of political interest and political concerns. And that maybe in many ways is actually, let's say, thrown out the Islam of the study of Islam in China, thrown out the theological debates and real serious motivations of these different reform movements. The perhaps some trying to, as you've explained to us there, then that the Ikhwan really in many ways maintaining so much of the earlier legal and theological dimensions of earlier tradition, albeit with newer input of acquiring more recent texts from other scholars through their journeys. And then from the 30s onwards, then of the figure Ma Dabao you've mentioned in particular, has his really long life. What, 1867 to 1977, if that's actually the credible dateline? You can tell us about that. But still, from the 30s, he was in the late Republican period, then he's very active. But of course, by the mid-20th century, 1949, China becomes a communist state, People's Republic of China, the PRC. And that leads to this period, then these decades, 40 years or something, really 30, 40 years, of the closing of borders, the purging of religious institutions in China during the Cultural Revolution, particularly in the 60s and 70s, and then the opening up again to the world in the 1980s and 90s. So can you give us a brief sense, Mohammed, of how the fortunes of the Chinese Salafis and the Ikhwan, the two movements you've discussed for us in the early 20th century, how their fortunes changed then during the period of the PRC? And perhaps looking from the outside, how did Saudi Arabia try to shape the post-Mao, the post-cultural revolution trajectory of Muslim religious developments in the PRC, in communist China?
I mean, it's interesting when thinking about the Salafis and the Ikhwan, because they've had kind of 180 degree turns in terms of their fortunes, and probably maybe a reversion of 180 degrees. So when the communists took over in 1949, that meant effectively the end of Muslim warlord rule. And so that also ended the dominance of the Ikhwan in the Northwest, at least, right? So the project of kind of ending sectarian differences and unifying Muslim groups did not have any more political support. So the Ikhwan actually kind of became disempowered, but it also took place in parallel with the emergence of kind of government-created Islamic institutions at the national level that were actually also ironically largely dominated by the Ikhwan. So while the Ikhwan lost kind of a much more active interventionist policy or a pathway to kind of reshape religiosities at the societal level, they kind of gained institutional power, which continues today, right? If you look at the Islamic Association of China, a lot of the people who make up that organization roughly come from Ikhwani background. But for the Salafis, what's interesting is that in the 1950s, and again, this is kind of a transitional period, right, where there was a lot of things going on, and really the crackdowns on religion and religious practice only take place from 1957 onwards, right, with the anti-rightist campaigns, and then after that, the Great Leap Forward, is that the Salafis were actually beneficiaries of communist rule for different reasons. I mean, one, there was now freedom of religion and freedom, of course, from religion, right, kind of enshrined in the different constitutions of the PRC. So they could openly express their doctrinal as well as madhhabi differences from the Ikhwan. They become much more assertive. In fact, in the 1950, there were several conferences and gatherings held to have doctrinal and legal debates with the Ikhwan, particularly. And there's, of course, one kind of interesting interpretation as to why was that the case. I mean, why did the Salafis benefit in the 1950s, which is that in kind of the PRC's emerging interpretations of the sectarian landscape, and this was still kind of developing in that period, the most problematic groups were the Sufi tariqas. Because, you know, essentially they were hereditary institutions. They had land holdings. I mean, they were never really that extensive, but essentially they had all the characteristics of a feudal landlord elite that had to be combated, you know, and kind of reified in religious form, which is even more problematic. But then the Salafis, you know, did not have any kind of material basis or support. They had kind of they had no organizational coherence to themselves, right? So in many ways, they were really beneficiaries of that early period. Now, come the late 1950s, effectively everyone, regardless of their confessional and madhhabi or doctrinal orientations, were all suppressed. I mean, there's In the early 1960s, there's a brief interlude where things are relaxed somewhat, but for much of the Maoist era, everything goes underground. Now, Ma Dabao, actually, I think he was exiled to Tibet, if I'm not mistaken. But again, the problem with the Salafi movement and its history is that much like the Ikhwan, the sources about them are really limited, right? I mean, for instance, in the case of the Salafis, aside from kind of the secondary literature by people like Ma Tong, and again, Ma Tong is quite interesting because much of his material, people don't realize, was collected in the 1950s in the context of him being a United Front official. So he was part of the system that was oriented towards managing non-communist elites and groups. Especially in the Northwest. And so he had an opportunity to collect actually a lot of data and conduct interviews with a lot of people, some of which, might have been under coercion or they offered information, taking in consideration certain political sensitivities and whatnot. So that was one source for the Salafiyya, among other literatures that are quite similar. But others are like, recollections of the descendants of Ma Dabao. Right, which can be also problematic because they're kind of removed. And even more recently, I found an unofficial history of the Salafiyya movement, which was written by effectively the person who is now the head of the Salafiyya network in Northwest China, although given the developments in the past few years, he moved to Malaysia. But he's also a graduate of Saudi Arabia and he kind of published it online. But again, there are problems with that because, it's filtered through a particular reimagining of the past. And, we don't really have primary sources from that era, which makes it quite difficult. Come the 1980s, right, and we have this post-Maoist context, right, where there's relative freedom of religion, re-engagement with the outside world. The state courting diplomatically a lot of Muslim states, some of which have already normalized ties or are in the process of normalizing it. And that kind of creates a lot of different opportunities for Muslim communities to go on the Hajj, to begin to consume kind of new types of literature, audiovisuals coming from elsewhere in the Muslim world, Malaysia, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Turkey. And also kind of going on extended study in those places. I mean, Pakistan, it really kind of takes a prominent position in the early period, but other countries also follow suit. So what happens is that there's this environment of openness, and it leads to kind of a breakdown and a growing grassroots-led religiosity and revival all across kind of the Islamic landscape in China. And of course, this has implications for different groups, right? So, for instance, the Salafis experience quite extensive growth. I mean, if we look at a lot of kind of the Chinese fieldwork studies and that have been conducted by kind of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences research entities dealing with religion, we find that, there is extensive Salafi growth all across the country, right? Mosques are becoming Salafi, et cetera. We see also the entrance of new actors that had not existed in the Islamic landscape before. The Tablighi Jama'at makes entries into China during this period in the 1980s and 1990s. So there's Khuruj, or mentions of Khuruj in Yunnan in the Northwest. Leila Chibbi, who I had already mentioned, but also Ruslan Yusupov, they work on the Tablighis or have written about them in these different places. It might be worth looking at for your listeners. And we also begin to see older traditional groups begin to lose their coherence, right? So the Ikhwani split, for example, that I had mentioned between the hardliners and softliners is really a process that begins from the 1980s onwards. And it has a lot to do with the fact that you have different types of social and cultural capital that are gained by different clerics and different ulema. In the context, in this new environment. So, for instance, a lot of the hardliners are people who are products of the older traditional education system from the 1940s, 1950s. They had experienced, of course, the Cultural Revolution and had resurfaced in the post-Maoist era. But then you have this new grouping of people who are educated in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, elsewhere. And this type of social cultural capital that comes with studying in the Muslim hinterlands creates kind of these new asymmetries and imbalances, right, in terms of traditional authority, who is learned, who is not, who has a credible interpretation of Islam and who does not. And this kind of leads to processes of implosion within these different groups. And some similar things or dynamics unfold among the Sufi tariqas, which also kind of experience succession issues, problems related to the proper interpretation of ritual and practice. So in a way, the last 40 years from the beginning of the post-Maoist era is a period of globalization, fragmentation, and the reimagining of Islamic practices and identities all across the Chinese Islamic landscape. Right. Now, this is kind of brings us to Saudi Arabia, I suppose. Now, Saudi, of course, you know, it's kind of always seen as exercising considerable influence, not just in the Chinese Islamic context, but elsewhere. But I think also sometimes we are prone to over-exaggerating the extent of that influence. So, for instance, when we talk about the genesis of the Salafi movement in China in the 1930s, I mean, I had mentioned Al-Hujandi. Al-Hujandi was a beneficiary of Saudi state patronage, but was he necessarily representative of what we would consider to be the state-endorsed Salafi interpretation or corpus, right? They didn't study under any Najdi scholars, at least none that I know of. And also certainly I think it tends to invisibilize the agency of a lot of these people, right? Because the Salafis, for example, are a good case of this. In the 1930s and 1940s, we have a lot of people going to the Hejaz, collecting texts and bringing them back in. And this is something that's revived in the 1980s and 1990s. And in fact, we have groupings or networks of Salafis who go during that period to study in places like Medina University. And from their memoirs and from the interviews that I've conducted with some of them, they were the ones who oftentimes initiated contact with Saudi organizations and ulama to gain support, right? And usually they're given money, but then they're the ones who dispense that money in ways that might not necessarily mirror the promises that were given to their benefactors or sponsors. So this whole idea of diffusion is something that we might need to rethink or at least complexify a bit. And I think another important point to remember is that Saudi, at least from 1949 up to 1990, did not have formal ties with the People's Republic of China, right? I mean, Saudi had very intimate ties with the Republic, which, you know, the nationalists had retreated to Taiwan after the Civil War. A lot of the Muslim warlords had either relocated to Taiwan, some had moved to the Hejaz, in fact, like Ma Bufang, who was the ruler in Xining, in Qinghai, the main benefactor of the Ikhwan. And in fact, he eventually took on Saudi citizenship and died in my hometown, the Jeddah, 1975. The Saudis, like their engagement with the East Asian religious landscape, was primarily driven by anti-communist solidarity with specifically the Republic of China, but also in a more broader sense with the other anti-communist frontier states like South Korea, Japan to some extent, as well as South Vietnam. So there was not much actually engagement except through the prism of anti-communist activities. So you have, for example, Saudi visitors going to Taiwan in the 1950s and 1960s as part of these organized tours by the local authorities there. And they would, for instance, participate in inflating balloons that are carrying anti-communist Muslim literature to the mainland, right? Or you would have certain figures like very prominent Saudi Hijazi technocrats like Ahmed Jamjoum or Hassan Kutbi, who were part of that circuit of the Asian People's Anti-Communist League conferences that were held in Saigon, Taipei, Seoul, etc. And of course, they injected the pan-Muslim vision of the Faisalian state, right? Because under King Faisal, Saudi Arabia had kind of embraced that as a platform against Arab progressive secularism coming from Egypt, and they had founded the Muslim World League. They were injecting that language, But there wasn't much in terms of actually influencing religiosities on the ground. That
Right.
begins to change in the 1980s when we begin to see kind of this soft beginnings of normalization. The state relaxes controls over people going on pilgrimage, and oftentimes officials or Muslims with some semi-official capacities go and engage with Saudi officials, but also they invite Saudi-backed Muslim organizations to come to China. For example, the Muslim World League conducts fact-finding missions in the early 1980s. But what's interesting is if you read the memoirs of the people who are involved with it, right? People like Ahmed Jamjoum, who I'd mentioned, was kind of a Cold War warrior. I think he was chosen to go on one of these fact-finding missions because of his credentials as an anti-communist who would not be deluded and tricked by communist machinations. But even people like Nasser al-Aboudi, who is, someone who had worked for the Muslim World League for decades, I think wrote something like over 90 or 100 books, and had traveled to nearly every place across the Muslim world imaginable and non-Muslim world to visit Muslim minorities. And he wrote actually 5 books about his visits to China. We can see that the Muslim World League and kind of the Saudi benefactors had no sense of the Islamic landscape there, right? They were interacting with people with no sectarian blinders, right? They, for example, they were dispersing money, but they were dispersing it to any mosque that would ask so. Right? And even in kind of my later interviews with a lot of Saudi organizations, because there's kind of this imaginary of the Saudi state as promoting actively Wahhabism, which there are infrastructures and points of diffusion, but I think it's also an oversimplification. We can see that, the people who have the file of dealing with Chinese Islam, they don't know anything about the Islamic landscape, right? They interface with state entities and organizations, and they might have personal ties through students who are oftentimes Salafis, but not always. I think that really raises a lot of questions about to what extent is Saudi Arabia or did Saudi Arabia reshape actively that landscape? Now, nowadays, there's a lot of people who claim that is the case. And, even, the Chinese state from 2016 had this anti-Saudiization campaign, which is actually anti-Salafization. But I think a lot of that exaggerates the extent to which there was actually exerted Saudi influence. And we need to really work more on that in terms of thinking about the globalization of different Islamic strands across the world.
And that really makes sense, given what you've told us over the last hour, Muhammad, just that the sheer complexity of different Muslim organizations or communities without necessarily sort of centralized organizations or leaders that one could go to, the linguistic challenges of which I hope listeners will recognize that you have overcome as a fluent reader of very complex theological texts in Chinese, as well as, of course, in your native Arabic and very complex texts in Arabic at that. So the sheer political, intellectual, social, sort of on the ground, even geographical, the problems of access, that actually kind of really makes sense that what you've said, that yeah, that it's all very well to talk about Saudi influence in China. How would that really happen, given what you've told us about the sheer on the ground complexities, the linguistic challenges, and of course the issues of access and interaction. So to wrap up then, if we look back across the 20th century as a whole, what would you say were perhaps the couple of most important changes in the way that Islam is practiced and understood among the Chinese speaking Muslims communities?
It's difficult really to conclude with such a question. I mean, one could go on for hours. But I think, looking back at the 20th century, and I think my colleagues in the field could proffer and provide many different interpretations about what are the critical changes that happened. But I would say that there are two tendencies in tension that have marked the development of Chinese Islam. On the one hand, is kind of this attempt, particularly by different iterations of the state, to unify, control, and make legible the Islamic landscape in China, right? So we could say that the earlier iterations of that were the Muslim warlords in the Northwest, who tried to kind of eliminate differences through kind of this project of promoting a modern orthodox vision of Islam embodied by the Ikhwan. But I think also under the People's Republic, I mean, and of course there was different oscillating experiments that ended up with a vision of the Islamic landscape as ossified along particular Muslim groups and sects. Now that kind of classification system that I had mentioned with Ma'tong, the one that we have the Qadim, the Sufi Tariqas, the Ikhwan, the Shidaotang, et cetera, that was adopted by the Chinese state. And actually that is now kind of the operative vision of how the state thinks about the Islamic landscape and its diversity within China, right? And that has, of course, implications on, say, how the state governs and how it manages. But one key element in that is that the state, in its internal documents and speeches by officials in the United Front, will not permit the emergence of new groups or sects. And cadres who are dealing, for example, with religion must be on guard against further fragmentation. The idea being is that you already have a set of groups and you have to arrest any organic changes and developments within Chinese Islam. And of course, there's a lot of different reasons for that. You know, some people say, well, it's divide and conquer. Some people would argue and offer other interpretations for it. But I think that tendency of centralization and trying to make legible and to control through particular elites that represent these different groups is one key development that had dramatically altered and changed Chinese Islam. And it kind of occurs in parallel and in a similar way to the rise of Minzu and ethnic markers of identity, right? But then the other tendency, I would say, is despite the state centralization efforts, you have continued fragmentation, right? Which I guess is part of the experience of Islam all across the world, right? There are many, many different forms of, and expressions of Islam that go down to the individual level. And I think no matter how much states and outside actors try to arrest that and promote very unitary visions, it's an impossible task to do. People are, even now, given the state's controls on the Islamic landscape for the past 7, 8 years, people are still consuming different information streams. There are new groups that are not or are completely invisibilized by the state sectarian paradigm that have gained considerable following in China, such as the Tablighi Jama'ah, you know. I think these two tendencies are kind of the fundamental poles that have defined the practice and belief in Islam among Chinese Muslims in the 20th century.
I have learned certainly so much over the last hour of talking to Muhammad, even though I've read a few, quite a few books on Islam in China and made a few visits of my own. And I hope listeners have learned at least something of the many things I've learned from you in conversation with you today. Dr. Muhammad Sadeh, thank you so much for speaking to us on Akbar's Chamber.
Well, thank you so much, Niall, for having me and giving me the opportunity to connect with the listeners, you know, and I look forward to the next episodes as well. I'm an active listener of the
Ah, wonderful. That's what we want to hear. It stops me. I don't even
podcast.
have to advertise. You've done it for me. Thank you so much.
Da 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 da